Welcome to Inside Economics. I'm Mark Zandi, the chief economist of Moody's Analytics, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Chris Derides and Marissa DiNatale. Hi, guys.
Hey, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
We had a busy week.
Chris. Yeah, we saw each other in person for the first time in
that
a
was kind of
very long
cool.
time. Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of
it was
cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, did you see, did you, it was the all hands day, or we had actually 2 days where everyone came together in Westchester, Pennsylvania, our kind of previous HQ. There's no HQ now, right? We're remote, but it was good to have everyone in person. Did you see anybody that you go, oh, you're taller than I expected, or you're shorter?
Absolutely.
Than
yeah, that happened
Absolutely.
a lot.
It happened to me a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Any, do you want to name names? No, you don't want to do, you don't want to go there.
No, that's
no. All right. Right. Yeah. But it was a good 2 days. It's really, I think remote is, this is Mark Zandi's view. I think remote's working well, but you got to have these events where you get together and see each other. It just doesn't work otherwise. You guys agree with that?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much.
Probably
so.
Probably more than once a year too.
That would be nice. That would be nice. In a nice spot. It doesn't have to be in Westchester, Pennsylvania, does it?
No, it does not. We could go visit Marissa next time.
That's yeah, it. I'd be all for that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if we had the budget for that, but yeah.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
She's in this hoity-toity, where are you, Laguna Beach or something? I don't know. With the movie stars?
Yeah, I'm in Dana Point.
Oh, Dana Point. Oh, yeah. See, Laguna Beach isn't hoity-toity enough for her. She has to say Dana Point.
I think Laguna Beach is a little more hoity-toity.
Are you a surfer? I mean, I think anyone who lives on Dana Point has to be a surfer. Isn't there like a Ritz-Carlton on Dana Point or something? Yeah. And and you look down into the ocean and there's surfers all the time.
Yeah, that's a big surf beach right below it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you see the seals and the sharks and all that kind of stuff. No?
I don't know about that, Mark.
Okay.
Sharks.
You see surfers.
I thought there were sharks. Anyway.
There are.
Versus a paddler.
Yeah, I'm a paddler.
Oh, is that right? Interesting.
Outrigger, canoe, paddler.
What does that mean exactly? Outrigger canoe. It's a canoe?
It is. It's a Hawaiian sport. And I'm on the Dana Point team. It's a team.
Oh.
So it's a racing team. So 6 months out of the year, I do this like 3 days a week, 3 or 4 days a week. And we race other teams up and down the Southern California coast. Some people go to Hawaii to do races. Yeah, it's a big part of my life, Mark, outside of
that
worrying
is cool.
about economics.
That is cool. Is it an Olympic sport?
No, it's not an Olympic sport yet, but
should be.
My coaches certainly treat it as if it's an Olympic sport.
Oh, and you have coaches too.
Oh yeah, it's a big,
this is serious.
It's a real thing. It's a real
it's
thing.
A real
it's
thing.
A big deal here. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah, this is the largest and oldest outrigger. The Dana Outrigger team is the largest and oldest outrigger team in the United States. And the women's team in particular is the best in the world, I would say.
Oh.
Maybe like Tahiti's better, but our top
gosh.
Crews are yeah.
Is it like, I know crew where you race in a straight line. Is that kind of sort of what you do here? You race in
No. So these are longer races. So our first couple months are 10 to 12 mile races. Then the last part of the season are these 9-man races where they're 30 mile races and you switch paddlers out in the water. People jump in the water. The canoe comes, you have to, the people in the canoe jump out one side and the other, the people getting in the canoe get in the other side. So you can, it's like a relay.
That is so cool.
And you have one paddle, right? Crew's oars, you're rowing. This isn't rowing, you're paddling.
Right.
So you do like several strokes on one side and then everybody switches over to the other side. So every other person is paddling on a different side of the canoe.
Six people
in the canoe.
My whole worldview just changed like completely. I thought you were this Maven statistics game player, but you're a Maven statistics game
I'm
player
both.
And an out, what did you call it? Outrigger canoer?
Yeah.
Cool. Very, very interesting. Chris is much more boring than you. Oh, yeah.
No, Chris is pretty interesting.
Is he pretty? we're gonna have to dive into that. So I know he likes bocce ball. I know that. And I know he plays enough. He's big in the crypto markets. I know that.
You've got me pegged, Mark.
I got you pegged, man. I got you pegged. And I know you like going to Italy in the summertime. And for 3-4, it feels like 6-8 weeks, he's sitting in some wine cellar somewhere, sipping something while he's chatting with us.
We can dream, right? We can dream.
I called you out, man. Yeah. Dream. Anyway, well, we have a guest, Rebecca Rocky. Good to see you.
Yes. Thank you for having me, Mark.
Did you know that about Marissa and Rebecca? Did you have any idea?
I did not. And my worldview just changed as well, actually. So we're in the same boat. So pun intended. No pun intended.
Yeah, right. And Rebecca, you're the, what's your official title? I know you're deputy chief economist at Cushman Wakefield. You are?
Yep,
yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about you, how you landed at Cushman Wakefield and became deputy chief economist, and maybe a little bit about Cushman as well, because we're going to talk about commercial real estate. And obviously Cushman's a force in CRE, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about that as well.
Sure. So I ended up in CRE kind of by accident, but from what I hear, that is sort of normal for the industry.
Oh, and Rebecca, can I ask while you're telling us the bio, can you fill in, like, are you like an outrigging canoe kind of person or something similar? Do you have any of those things going on? I'd be very curious, just so I get the right worldview of you.
Yeah. So on the side for 15 years, I did teach fitness classes. And I spent a great deal of time doing indoor cycling. I taught for Flywheel before the pandemic for 5 of the final years. I did that. Had a small business that ran boot camps and taught kickboxing and all kinds of random.
Oh, so you're
things,
in great so. Shape. You and Marissa been hanging out.
Yeah, well, probably not ready to compete with Tahiti's outrigger canoe team, but definitely enjoy being active. I have a 20-month-old, so you know, things have changed a lot, but that's really fun as well. So
absolutely.
Yeah, so
sorry,
I had that
I didn't
sort
mean
of
interject. Yeah.
No, that was my you know, that was my I would moonlight at night as a fitness instructor at 6 a.m. But I ended up in CRE sort of by accident. I moved to DC originally and was thinking I was going to go into international development. I was really fascinated by microfinance and I just thought this is where I'm going to go. And turns out, you know, some of the more quantitative work in that field, it was a bit nascent at the time. And that was something that intrigued me, was doing more quantitative work. And I actually don't remember applying to the Congressional Budget Office, but evidently I did. And I was hired in the financial analysis division and did a lot of work. Yeah. And actually my first manager was Deborah Lucas, who's now at MIT. I was there under Doug Elmendorf, and Damian Moore was my manager when she left. So
I didn't know that. That is so interesting.
Damian told me that when I saw him the other day. Yeah.
Yeah.
For folks out there, Damian is with us at Moody's and manages our financial economics unit. So that's really cool. I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I was there in that research assistant role that's very typical of CBO and the Fed. Worked on a lot of federal credit, sort of FCRA related work. The group I was in did a lot on the GSEs, but I was sort of working on the first comprehensive fair value estimate of the federal credit programs, which at the time was about, I think, $3 trillion in outstanding exposure. And so definitely did not arrive with that expertise. So it was a great experience. I have very fond memories of CBO and, of course, keep in touch with many people, including Damian from those days. I left there. I briefly went into consulting. Fannie Mae was my primary account that I was working on, doing modeling of loss reserves and things like that. It was not quite the best fit. And it wasn't that it was the being at Fannie. It was just something was not quite a fit. And one of
Were you at Fannie? Did you go to Fannie?
Well, I was consulting for them. So I was specifically there. Okay.
Because yeah, Chris was a Fannie alum. Yeah.
And I got a call randomly from a guy I was friends with at CBO, and he said, my wife is a land broker at Cassidy Turley. They're looking for an economist who's going to sort of be the right hand for the chief economist. I think you'd be a good fit. You know, do you want to kind of explore this? And I thought, you know, I really don't even know what Cassidy Turley is or commercial real estate. But I thought, you know, why not? I'm not loving what I'm doing. And so I went and I explored this option. I got an offer and decided to go into commercial real estate. I just had my 10-year anniversary in January. But the firm has gone through a lot of evolution. So I joined in January 2014. Cassidy Turley was a sort of large player in the US market, but it was not a global firm. We merged with DTZ pretty much within that first year. I think it was January of 2015 or so. And we became global in that merger. Then 9 months later, we merged with Cushman. And we were already global at that point, but we became now the third largest commercial real estate firm in the world. And since then, it's been, you know, it's been a journey. The company's evolved a lot. We went public. We went through a pandemic. And the market has changed tremendously over that 10-year period. So I think what I love about CRE is it touches everything from policy to demographics to, you know, technology to the economy. Every property type interacts with the world we live in different ways. So it's just really interesting. And that's what's, you know, I fell in love with. Our firm is, as I mentioned, the third largest in the world. Last year, revenues of about $9.5 billion. We have about 50,000 employees around the world, around 400 offices or so. So we're pretty large. We're full service. So what that means is we don't just do brokerage, although we do obviously have a tremendous brokerage business. And for those of your listeners that aren't familiar with CRE or full service brokerage firm, brokerage is really just we're representing buyers and sellers in the capital markets, and we're representing landlords and tenants in the leasing markets. But we also offer, you know, things like valuation and advisory. We have property management, asset management. We have a global occupier services business to really bring together all of our functions to serve the largest occupiers of real estate in the world. And, you know, in many cases, they own and rent assets across different kinds of property types for their business. And we offer a slew of other services, but that kind of gives you a flavor for the kinds of things that we do and really having more tentacles out there than just transactions.
And you're around the world at this point. So you're global. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did. That's such a cool history. I didn't know that. Can I ask who's one and two? When you say you're number, Cushman's number three, who's one and two?
CBRE and JLL.
JLL. Okay. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. Well, we're going to have you back to talk about fair value. I know that's a Debbie Lucas thing, I've got my own pet theory about fair. We probably shouldn't go down that rabbit hole, but
about the discount rate.
But anyway,
it was a contentious thing, you know, like OMB was very stick with FCRA. CBO is just saying we should have this second estimate that's more fair value, more representative of the credit risk embedded in that discount rate.
It's a whole thing. Probably shouldn't go there because you got to explain FCRA. You got to, but it's a very important because a big part of what the federal government does is provide a backstop to all parts of the financial system and provides credit, you know, backstops the availability of everything from small business lending to mortgage lending and everything in between. And the question is, how do you assess the impact of that, all that, on the government's budget? And that's a complicated issue. And actually has enormous implications. You know, how you do the accounting has enormous implications for, you know, what you can do here or not do. But anyway, but we're not going to do, we'll have you back if you're willing to go into that can of worms.
But we'll I thought get Damien for that one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah. I haven't talked to him. I guess I've talked to him. You know, Damien, he's one of these guys, you talk to him and you're not sure where he stands after you talk to him. Like, if you talk to me, I tell you exactly what I think. Damien, I guess it's more a little bit more academic, right? I mean, he thinks about it from all yeah. sides and second order, third order conditions, that kind of thing. Before we dive into the commercial real estate market, let's talk a little bit about the economy, because that's obviously key to what's going on in CRE. And maybe the way we can do this, and I'll turn it back to Chris at this point, just to talk about, got a plethora of, how about that for a big word? Plethora. Is that a big word? Yeah, I think it is. It's a good
medium
word.
Medium word.
A plethora of data this week. The question is to Chris, after seeing all this data this week, how are you thinking about the economy? What do you think? Stronger, weaker, better, worse?
Yeah, I'd say the word comes to mind is resilient, incredibly resilient, right? Just, it seems like months or weeks ago, but the past weekend we had the Iranian attack on Israel, right? So Monday morning, the mood was things are going to fall apart here in terms of oil prices spiking. But, despite that, we've seen things kind of hold together. And then we had a slew of reports this week on the U.S. economy that indicate that consumers remain relatively strong. I look at the retail sales report, shows consumers are still spending, right? Still willing to spend. So I think there's a lot of strength here. There are certainly some, as usual, we can always point to some causes for concern, but overall, it still seems like a very robust, resilient, strong economy.
Yeah, I mean, the events in the Middle East played out, at least, well, it's still a script being written here.
Yes.
It's going to be written for a long time to come, but at least the script that's written over the last few days probably couldn't have been any better given what happened last weekend when Iran attacked Israel. I mean, it feels like, of course, the Iranians didn't, it feels like they didn't really want to do a lot of damage. They just wanted to send a message. And the Israeli response, where it's this Friday, the 19th, the Israelis responded by doing an attack in Isfahan in Iran, but they didn't want to do much damage either. They just wanted to send a signal that, hey, we can bomb in Iran as well. So feels like, couldn't ask for kind of a better outcome given where we were a week ago. Agreed?
Well, you can always ask for more, right? It's still a very tense situation, to your point. Yeah. It's
but oil prices are down. They're not up. So
correct. Right. Yeah. So, but I think you need to emphasize your point about this script is still being written. This is just the first round. And in some way, if you want to get fearful, we've kind of opened the Pandora's box here now, right? It's no longer off limits to attack these countries to attack each other directly. So, still need to be cautious here. But at least for now, this seems like it was a more measured response.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Rebecca, do you watch the economic data just as closely as, obviously we do? I think you do, don't you? You're like all over the data.
I do. I pick and choose the ones I pay more attention to than less. But I absolutely watch the data and the markets every single morning.
Mm-hmm. And what's your sense of things at this point in the economy?
I would echo what Chris said. One is resilience. Two, I've been sort of surprised to the upside about, how oil markets have responded to what's going on. I would have guessed, if you had asked me last week, if this happened, probably oil would be closer to 90 than to 80. But that's obviously not the case. And generally, I think we can agree that's good for U.S. consumers and the U.S. economy that oil prices didn't spike in any way. But, looking at some of the data that came out this week that, are relevant for CRE, we saw retail sales, again, Chris mentioned that, pretty robust report on the back of some weaker reports, but, we generally tend to see weaker reports at the beginning of the year. So that was moving in the right direction. I also looked, manufacturing. We got some early indications last month from the ISM. Things could be stabilizing there. We saw some more diffuse activity in the manufacturing output Capacity utilization still low, but kind of at least moving up a little bit. So those were the two that I looked at a little bit more closely. I don't want to talk about the other one because I might use it for the statistics. So, you know.
I'm glad you're going to play. I'm sure. Yeah. I have a feeling you're going to be really good at it. So the retail sales, obviously, for the retail part of CRE, and we'll definitely come back to that in a minute or two. And then industrial manufacturing activity, you mentioned the ISM, the survey, the Institute for Supply Management. I think that's what it's called, right? The purchasing managers, yeah. Which gives you a read on manufacturing activity. And that feels like it's starting to perk up here a little bit. And that's a good thing for the industrial market.
Yeah, and for freight markets, which a lot of the freight activity is generated from the U.S. manufacturing sectors, and that has been really experiencing some tough conditions. I wouldn't expect those to turn quite, you know, one-on-one with manufacturing perking up, but if it's sustained, that's a really good indicator for where the freight markets could head.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Marissa, anything on your radar screen?
Yeah, I was just after yesterday's events with Israel attacking Iran, I was scared to look at the oil market, but I was surprised that prices were actually down. Jobless claims still not going anywhere. We got median weekly earnings too. They're falling on a year ago basis. They're 3.5% year over year. That's BLS data. So that's good from an inflation standpoint, which is good to get some positive inflation data. I guess home sales were not good, right? Home sales fell quite a bit. But as Becky said, the manufacturing data was good. We got industrial production data that was positive as well. So yeah, it's remarkably resilient so far.
Yeah, I was looking at those UI unemployment insurance claims because they're a window into layoffs. And it's like someone is drawing a line.
I mean, it went from like 211 to 212. I mean, they've been in this 210 range, right? Forever, it seems.
And the 4-week moving average, I think I'm making this up, but it's like 215 or 210.
Yeah.
And it's been that way for a long time.
Yeah.
It's like I've never seen anything like it, actually.
Right.
It's pretty bizarre. But that, and 210 is low. That's a low level
it
of
is,
claims. Yeah. So, Rebecca, you know, obviously for CRE, interest rates matter a lot for lots of different reasons.
Yes.
What's your sense, you know, given the resilience of the data? And of course, last week we were talking about inflation. We got all that the inflation data, which was on the hot side. CPI came in hot. And interest rates have pushed up here a little bit. And expectations for first Fed rate cut have been pushed out. What's your view on interest rates, both in terms of the Fed, in terms of long-term rates?
I think, I'll start with the Fed. We had been in the June camp for the first rate cut up until the CPI report. And I think coming into that report, I knew as well as our team knew, you know, we need to see some really almost, you know, perfect reports for the next few, given how you know, many jobs the economy is creating and so on. And for CPI specifically, you can go back to last summer and see on the 3-month annualized rate basis, it started to pick up and this was just a continuation of that. And so we knew we needed to see that pattern start to reverse. And when we didn't, when it came in hot yet again, and the Fed's been very clear, you know, you've got to have multiple reports that tell us this is moving in the right direction. Although it's not their preferred measure, you know, they look at everything. And it really was the nail in the coffin, we think, of the June cut. Markets obviously generally agree. We did push our first cut out to September as well. And we had a September and a December cut. So we were thinking 325 bips each. Now we pushed it out to September. Really, you know, my view on that is for September to happen, we do need to start to see those improvements and consistently. And we're really hanging our hat on housing inflation starting to unstick a bit. So if you look at housing inflation, PCE or CPI, right, it's been kind of leveling off on a 6-month annualized rate basis. So that should come down with a lag. That lag is just taking longer than we thought, and I think really than anyone thought. But assuming that that historical relationship reasserts itself, and given the importance of housing in either index, even though it's lower than in PCE than CPI, we would think that the Fed would also want to get ahead of any further slowing in the economy, given how monetary policy does operate with long and variable lags. So we're still holding on to the September call. We acknowledge the risks of fewer rate cuts has gone up than even that, right? That more no landing scenario. I think Apollo's chief economist has said no rate cuts this year. He's been there for some time. I think the likelihood of that has gone up. That's not our base case, put it that way. On the long end, there's no doubt about it seeing a 4.
By the way, maybe on the Fed, just very quickly.
Oh yeah,
because our forecast is the same. We have we had a June with this a cut in a quarter point, then one in September, one in December, and with the CPI report that dashed the prospect for a June cut. So we now have a September cut and a December cut, and then a quarter point each quarter after that, in 25 and or into 26. And I'm beginning to wonder, if I were sitting at the Fed and, we're talking now September right before the election. Right. And clearly this election is going to be very contentious. It's going to be close and very contentious and very easy to see the Fed getting politicized. And whatever decision they make, they could get politicized if they don't cut rates, if they cut rates. But it feels like they have a much greater chance of getting politicized if they cut rates in September, because that's like right in the teeth of the, back and forth politically. I'm beginning to think if I were sitting there, if I'm going to wait till September, I might as well wait till November. November would be just right after the election, to cut interest rates. What do you think of that kind of thought process?
It makes sense. Don't disagree. The whole political cycle is just starting to ratchet up, and it's going to be intense this year. My hope, and I think what they iterate, is data dependence, being independent, and having that as part of their reputation and credibility, I think is still a way that we think about the Fed. But I don't disagree; it's a possibility that they just want to abstain from having any kind of influence on outcomes and weight. It is a possibility. I think on the margin, two months till you cut 25 bips. I mean, I don't think it makes or breaks the economy in that way, but I do think we haven't moved our base case to that because of the election or something like that.
Yeah, I think Chris wants to move it to November, don't you, Chris? The first rate cut.
Yeah, I'm leaning that direction. I think the threshold for September for our first cut is really high. You really need that perfect set of reports that Rebecca mentioned. I'm just not clear we'll get it.
And by the way, this is all about.
If you don't get it, then why not wait? Right.
Yeah.
This is all about what are they going to do, not what they should do. I'm still. They should be cutting interest rates, in my view. But anyway, it's a whole different kind of discussion. So Rebecca, long-term interest rates. So the 10-year treasury yield, I didn't look today, but we've been hovering now at 4.5%, kind of on the high side of the range it's been in over the past year. We've been kind of sort of close to 4, up to 4.5. Actually, we got a little as high as 5 for a brief period of time, but back in. So where do you think the 10-year yield's going to be over the course of the next year or two?
As we look at a year or two, we think it will settle down into that 4% range. Obviously there's a lot of movement in that in any given period. And I have to say, obviously this resilient data has been feeding into a shift in expectations for Fed funds policy. Fortunately, we've continued to see, as you guys probably know, throughout the pandemic, expectations have remained very anchored. But, you know, the growth outlook is continuing to be revised up, you know, across consensus forecasts, including our own. And so I think, you know, that may create some of that upward pressure in the near term. But ultimately, we think kind of like what happened last year when we had that rally to 5, it ultimately came back down into the 4% range. I mean, the Fed will ultimately, with through forward guidance, whether it's later this year or some other time, start to give guidance on the pivot. And we would expect as they start to normalize monetary policy, we should see the 10-year come down. And roughly, you know, if you believe 2.5% R star, which I know that's a moving target that's unknown, you know, we would expect something like 4% over the medium term. That's where our forecast is at, kind of range bound 3.8 to 4.2 over time.
Yeah, we're kind of in the same place. Yeah, same ballpark for similar reasons. I think the kind of the stake in the ground for us is nominal potential GDP growth,
right,
which is about 4 to 4.5. You know, that's 2%. Yeah. Actually, real growth feels a little stronger right now for labor force growth, productivity growth. So maybe we're 2.25, something like that. And then you throw in 2% inflation, that's 4.25. In the long run, abstracting from the vagaries of the business cycle, those two things should be roughly equal to each other. And they are, you know, if you look historically. So it feels like we should be somewhere in the low fours, you know, something like that at this point in time. But that makes, of course, we're all going to be wrong about this for sure.
You know, one thing I would say is what we saw in CRE, at least with coming off of the 5% and then being stable at 4, we were seeing the market respond well to that. You know, CRE can operate in 4%, Treasury 4.2%, 10-year Treasury. It's that volatility that really creates issues in the market. So I'm sure we'll dig more into that, but that's been a little bit of, I think, cold water and sentiment that had been persisting in the first 3 months of the year where we were really seeing some unlocking in the markets. And, you know, we'll just have to watch how temporary this rally to 4.6, 4.7 is.
Well, maybe it's a good point to dive into, go right into commercial real estate. So I know you're play by play in the CRE market, but most of us aren't quite as, you know, play by play. So what you were saying is, you know, as if we go back, if you rewind to like end of last year, 6 months ago, the sentiment was pretty dark. You know, rates had gotten up 5%. It did CRE prices were starting to come in. You know, there was a lot of discussion of the so-called commercial real estate CRE doom loop, and we can talk a little bit about that. But you're saying at the beginning of this year, when rates came back in, when we got back down to a 4% 10-year treasury yield, and it felt like the economy was going to avoid a recession, you know, and now we're talking about how resilient it is, lots of jobs and retailing and so forth and so on, the sentiment has improved. But then now you're saying with the backup in yields, things feel a little less.
Yes. Sort of just skittish, like what's going on. I think it just tends to create a momentary pause, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you really think, oh, well, we'll get it down to 4 really soon, you know, then that can have a real impact. 50 basis points can have a real impact. And that quick and swift movement, the volatility is, you know, we call it kind of the enemy of transactions. And we'll just have to see how long that lasts. I think another part of the sentiment coming into this year was not only, you know, getting away from the 5% range, which probably scared us all to a certain degree for different reasons, but you know, the shift in forward guidance from the Fed, right? Seeing that the terminal rate is likely the one that we're at. Now we could debate that. Some people are, but we tend to think it is, and they've sort of reiterated that in their recent communications. And that forward guidance really, I think, sparked belief and conviction in the notion that CRE is nearing bottom, right? Especially on the capital market side. The pricing is in private markets, likely bottoming the first half of that year, this year. That was sort of what we were calling for. And so with that combined with Fed saying, hey, we think we'll probably be cutting rates next year and the 10 years coming down, all of those things, I think, created some sentiment and tailwinds for CRE capital markets. I still think they're there. I just, you know, this one week of data, I'm not going to extrapolate for even, you know, the whole month or quarter. But the kind of thing we saw this week is really just introducing that in that uncertainty, the uncertainty of interest rates that really creates more hesitance, right, in transactions. And once we see stability, that's when we start to see people move forward with decisions.
So your thought or thinking is that commercial real estate prices broadly are near a bottom. Is that what you're thinking?
Broadly, yes.
Really? Okay.
Depends on the asset class, of course, as I'm sure we'll talk a bit about. But we do think sort of in private markets, middle of this year will be the trough. And, you know, the second half of the year, we're not going to see crazy, you know, double digit price growth or anything like that. But we'll see probably some stabilization at that trough. And then we think we'll start to see some value growth next year.
And when you say prices, what do you use? Do you use our price? You should be using our price index, Rebecca. I'm just saying.
Well, we certainly do have that in our toolbox. We look at it.
What do you use when you say prices are going to bottom? What is it that you're measuring?
So we look at a lot of different measures. Okay. So there are different price indices, and some are repeat transaction based, like yours.
Right.
And we look at those. Some are appraisal based. And we look at those. Those tend to lag a little bit if they are truly based on appraisals. Mm-hmm. Green Street has a more novel method with sort of real-time appraisals, in not necessarily using appraisal methodology that appraisers use, to determine what they think is happening to values. And they tend to lead private markets. So they do give us a good indication, you know, with a bit of a lead to other indices. But of course, we also think about things like cap rates. We construct our own price index using some NCREIF and RCA data. Mm-hmm. And we look at all of them and try to think about broadly what's happening. And then, of course, we also have intelligence on the ground, what we're seeing in spot cap rates and bids that we're fielding on behalf of buyers and sellers. So all of that points to, for most property types, absent the 10-year really remaining anchored where it is, but if it were to kind of hang out where all of us think it's going to go, that we're likely near that trough. And we're seeing that with, you know, institutional investors starting to make actions based on that. You know, you've seen some major transactions happening with, you know, debt funds, equity funds, the first part of this year under the premise of, we want to get in before that value growth starts. We want to get in the window at trough pricing. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, for folks that don't follow the CRE market, and I follow it, and then I don't follow it because I'm following something else, and I come back. Whenever there's a problem in CRE, I'm following it. And of course, after 35 years of being an economist, I followed it a fair number of times. I'm always amazed at all the acronyms and different ways of measuring things, and what, you know, and you can get some very different perspectives, particularly in terms of price. You know, you think, you say, how hard can it be to measure a price? Well, it's really hard. It's really hard.
It's very hard.
Yeah, really hard to do. So, Chris, let me ask you, and everything you just said is in your kind of your baseline worldview, meaning no recession, resilient economy, interest rates kind of hanging around the fours, low fours, that kind of thing. That's, you're saying prices are, broadly speaking, yes, it varies across property type and, you know, region, so forth and so on. But broadly speaking, we're near a bottom. Chris, is that our, because Chris spends a lot of time on CRE too, and he manages the construction of our repeat sales indices. What we do is we get all the transactions that occur and know what the price is, and then we look at prices for properties the last time they transacted, and based on that, we can construct an index. And in theory, it controls for mix issues and that kind of thing.
Right.
But Chris, we're not saying there's a bottom, are we? We've got more to go here, don't we? In our forecast,
based on our index. Certainly, yes, that there is more to go, particularly in this, maybe this can start to pivot into some of the property types.
Yeah.
It's office, right? For us, office is just still at the beginning of its
That's the one exception to the rule of what I just said.
Yeah, but you're right. If you look at multifamily, it's already come down a lot. We don't expect there to be much more of a correction here. It just may take some time for it to grow at a very robust rate and just plateau here for a while as things adjust. But then other property types, industrial certainly looks great. It's actually continuing to grow. Retail is pretty solid. Hotel even looks pretty good. So I don't know that we're too far apart, right? Maybe a bottom is a little further out for us because of maybe the weight on office. But I think the story kind of holds here.
Hey, I'm looking at the clock here. I think we've been at this for 45 minutes already. I don't know where the time went, but this is what I want to do. I want to talk a little bit about the individual property types, and I've got for each one of them that I want to focus on, I've got something that's bugging me. So I'm going to ask you, to help unbug me, with regard to you. Then we're going to play the game, the stats game. And I got a great statistic that no one's ever going to get, but it's a great statistic, but I'm just saying. And then we'll come back and then we'll end on the, reassessing this idea that there's this commercial real estate doom loop, very quickly. Won't dwell on that, but just a little bit on that. Does that sound like a good game plan? Sound everyone okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So on what's bugging me, let's obviously office is kind of the office market is kind of front and center for people's concerns because, remote work, vacancy rates have risen quite considerably. Rents have actually held up pretty well, I guess, so far, at least because leasing takes a while to really filter through. When I look at office, I have a hard time constructing a scenario where that ever comes back. Remote work is here to stay. You can see it in the swipes data. There's swipe cards where you can see the number of people going into the office, and they're not coming back. It's kind of leveled off in most markets across the country, below pre-pandemic. And then we've got this demographic thing going on where the number of we've gotten a little bit of a bailout here because of all the immigration, but once we get past that, everyone's retiring and leaving, and the number of people in the labor force isn't going to grow nearly as quickly. Therefore, we're going to have fewer jobs, so less demand for space. And it's hard to convert a lot of these office properties. I think so. Isn't office going to be a problem for ever, Rebecca? Or am I overstating the case?
If it is a problem forever, I think fortunately in the long run we're all dead. But I think it has a transformation to go through. There's no doubt about it, and it's just a matter of which office we really dig into. So it's absolutely true that vacancy rates have been rising in most markets around the country, and in some not as much, but. There are, I think, important underlying themes there. So one would be the smaller the market, the greater the return to office has been, the less significant the supply wave. And actually, the increase in vacancy has been very marginal, maybe 250, 300 basis points.
What would be a good example of that when you say smaller market? What would that be?
You could put a Boise, a Palm Beach, a Fredericksburg, Virginia, Omaha, Nebraska, anything that's we consider them sort of tertiary markets would be how we describe them. And I point that out because, that's where a lot of smaller banks are lending. So when you worry about office exposure, the smaller the bank, the more likely their exposure is to these more resilient markets on the fundamental side. As you move into secondary markets, we've seen a more significant increase in vacancy. You've seen more influence from the supply side, which will thin out and is thinning out very, very rapidly. So examples of that would be Charlotte, Nashville, Salt Lake City, Raleigh, Durham. They've had a huge supply wave that has contributed to a large degree to that increase in vacancy. So on net, for example, Nashville has had positive occupancy gains. In terms of the level of occupied stock has gone up. There has not been what we call negative demand or negative absorption. Their vacancy has gone up because they're building a lot and they're experiencing tremendous office job growth as migration patterns benefit some of these lower cost Sunbelt markets. Of course, we do have an issue in some of the more larger cities, including our gateway cities. In those markets, vacancy has gone up about 12 percentage points. And there's no doubt that there is obsolete office product out there, that the impacts of remote work will be lasting, and that they will structurally impact demand. The way that we think about that is, one is we have a transition to get through, and then on the other side, for every new office job that you get marginally less demand. So you want to think about that from a longer term basis, but you also have to account for the adjustment of all the existing office leases that occupy, that, you know, house the 33, 34 million office workers that we had before the pandemic, and figure out how they're going to adjust. Now, our weighted average lease term across the 5.4 billion square feet that we track is 8.5 years. In larger cities, it's about 10, but in the aggregate, it's about 8.5. If companies that had space before the pandemic were just downsizing by 20% because of hybrid work, our vacancy rate would be roughly 40%. But it's not, it's 20%, because not all companies are downsizing. Not all companies, if they are downsizing by 20%. Some companies are expanding. And we have this offset that we account for in how we model that a disproportionate share of new jobs, even as demographics drive job growth lower over time, are created in knowledge sectors that use office space. And all of those things point to, after this adjustment and transition period, which we're still in, that we will on the margin start to see incrementally positive absorption in, we think it'll probably be late next year, more likely 2026 onward, and that we'll start to see these gains reaccrue. But you're going to have this overhang, right, of vacant space. And so right now we've just hit, for the first time ever in our data, 20.2% vacancy. It's the first time we went over that threshold. We've estimated that roughly 30% of that is just obsolete. You know, it needs to go. And so I think part of the transformation is we're going to be removing stock over time, and it's the weakest stock. I didn't think this was a fair stat for the stats game, because it's obviously a Cushman stats. You wouldn't know it. But
all's fair in that game. Yep.
So Class A is in fact about half of the office market, and people say, "Oh, B and C are really where it's hurting the most," and that is true. But there's a lot of Class A that is struggling as well, more commodity, older Class A, especially suburban office parks and so on. So when we look at the overall Class A vacancy rate right now, it is 22.8%. And just remember, you know, all new construction hits Class A, so there is a supply impact in that vacancy rate as well. About 12% of office buildings in the country, they're not disproportionately large. They're about 12% of inventory, right? So 12% have a 50% or higher vacancy rate. And if you took those buildings out, you said, well, I'm just going to get rid of that 10%, 12%. Instead of the vacancy rate being near 23%, it's actually 15.5%.
I see.
And so you'll hear about flight to quality, and you hear about obsolescence, but I think quantifying just the true concentration of weakness is really eye-opening. There really is a bottom 10, 15% in most markets that are weighing on these headline market stats, and most other product even, you know, is performing okay or even pretty well. In Class A, about 35% of buildings are fully leased, and another 10, 12% have a 10% or lower vacancy rate. And that's 4 years into the pandemic, as companies have been adjusting and recording this, you know, record-setting negative demand in the sector. So I think there are a lot of signs that companies really need this space, that it's not just this outright downsizing. Or the counterfactual would be, you know, 40% vacancy, and that's just not what we've seen. But there is this I would call it even more than a trifurcation, but I don't know what the actual word is to just, you know, to what's beyond trifurcation, where it's,
I like that word.
Yeah, top tier is doing great. We know that. The bottom, the obsolete stuff is really, really bad. Huge impact on vacancy, 730 basis point delta in the rates I just gave you. And then there's this middle, which is just going to reinvent itself. And that's going to take time. And it doesn't mean that that's easy or fun, especially for the owners of that. But we do believe that that space will ultimately serve a function in the office sector moving forward.
That's a really cool frame. I hadn't thought of it in that term. So that's very interesting. Well, just really quick, because I want to move on to a couple of what bugs me. AI, artificial intelligence, any concerns about that? And when it, because it feels like that would be focused on kind of office using occupations and employment. Any concern there, or is that still not on the radar screen?
I think, it's too soon to tell. We know there's obviously going to be displacement of some jobs. Any technology does that. We know there are going to be many jobs that are augmented. That's, in fact, in real time in the CRE industry, where we see deployment of AI is to help workers do their job, or to help, right, an asset manager or facilities manager manage that asset more efficiently, not replace the job of that facilities manager, right, to get smarter and more efficient with how we use buildings. So I think in that way, the jury's still out. Over the longer run, you know, when you look back at literature on technology disruptions, I followed some of the work of Darren Ace McGlue, and you know, he's looked at, you know, when in the 90s and the early 2000s, you have these technologies coming in, and over roughly half of all the new jobs that were created in that time period were jobs that never existed before. And I tend to have a glass half full view of creative destruction and the ingenuity of the American economy and the American, you know, sort of spirit in that way. Like, well, and frankly, you know, to your point earlier about demographics, there couldn't really be a better time to get a technology to supplement labor, you know, and make us more effective when we have, despite recent immigration, this longer term demographic deceleration on the horizon, right? To be able to augment the skills of labor to continue to produce 2.5% GDP moving forward seems like great timing, but you know, I think we'll just have to watch and see how it plays out. That's just my tilt is glass half full on. We'll find a way to create new jobs.
Yeah, makes sense. Hey, okay, so let's, offices seems to be the problem child. The one property type that kind of is surprised to the upside, and you definitely correct me if I'm wrong, but this is just me from my perch, and really confusing to me is retail. It's like retail is this darling property type, and that's despite continued increase in the share of retailing that's going to online. I mean, if you believe the data, and that was supposed to be the kind of the stake in the heart of retail forever. That, you know, maybe this is an important thing to think about when you think about office in the current context.
Right.
But what about retail? What the heck? What's going on there?
Well, we weren't surprised by this shift. In fact, we put out a series last year on the resilience of retail. And you can kind of think of it as like a 1-2-3 punch. You go through the GFC. E-commerce really started to accelerate in the property market impacts in the 2010s. So yes, it was happening before that, but it really wasn't until 2012, 13, 14, we started to see big players, one, juice the industrial market, right? Going in and getting warehouses and selling online these 1 million square foot facilities and bigger. And so you had that penetration happening. You also then had the pandemic, which, you know, that's kind of the final stake in the heart of any retailer that didn't.
Yeah, she's using my terminology. I'm influencing the way she speaks. Do you see that? I'm sure she never said stake in the heart until she heard me say it.
It was not part of my regular vocabulary.
Vocabulary, there you go.
It's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you survived all of that, you were generally in a pretty good position, and then you have an economy that's performing pretty well. Obviously, there's disparity among different kinds of income groups, and that translates into the kinds of retail categories that are in more aggressive expansion mode versus those that are in consolidation mode. But on net, the last few years, we've been recording positive absorption. We have a 40-year low in the vacancy rate. And it was, I think, some of the fears that you articulated and how people thought about retail that led to an underdevelopment cycle. So we were overbuilt on retail. Now, right now, we have something like 12 million square feet under construction, just to put that in perspective. That's across 83 cities and 4.3 billion square feet of shopping center stock. So you literally only have 12 million square feet that's underway. And that we have a 5.4% vacancy rate. If you're a retailer, you have very few options. And when store closures happen, you know, in many cases, there's a line of tenants waiting for that space, provided it's well located and, you know, meets their actual requirement needs. But, you know, we've really been excited about it. I would also say, just in the context of the interest rate movements, it was the least overpriced. I mean, it went through a pricing correction for a period of time. And so it had a lot of spread over the 10-year that, as that went up, we really didn't have to see cap rate expansion nearly to the degree that we have in other sectors. So that's something I can tell you is an investment theme heading forward as consumers rotate back to services, as we see certain kinds of shopping centers really perform well. I always say, you know, 1% of retail stock are buildings. The number of buildings are malls. It's 8% of the stock, 1% of the buildings. And so most retail are not malls. And even many malls are performing quite well because they're not all Class BC, you know, struggling in areas that have deindustrialized over the last few decades. So it's an exciting time, I think, for those in the sector who watch it. We weren't surprised, but I think because the media says retail apocalypse and, you know, those kinds of things, it can be surprising.
Yeah. I've got one more what bugs me, but maybe Marissa, do you have a what bugs me in the CRE market that you want to ask? Because I've been monopolizing the conversation. If not, no worry. Or Chris, it's got to be a good what bugs me.
I don't have a what bugs me. I actually have the opposite.
Oh, what's the opposite of what bugs
me? Well, I'm curious about sort of like the warehousing and the data centers and that segment of commercial real estate, which is, as far as I understand, right, doing very well for obvious reasons. And I was just curious to hear Becky's take on that.
It's a really great point because CRE is so diverse, and industrial is truly a darling. And I say that very genuinely. So we came off of a period where things were building out from an e-commerce penetration perspective before the pandemic. And so we knew what healthy runway rates were for demand, given the e-commerce taking up more and more a share of core retail sales. Then the pandemic hits. It was, I say this all the time, it was bananas. I mean, the levels of demand were wild. We estimate that half of the excess demand beyond normal was e-commerce providers essentially pulling forward future demand because they had to meet the needs during COVID. So there was this pull forward influence that occurred during COVID, and really juiced demand, and supply was trying to respond, but vacancies got below 3%. And just for context, in our data nationally, the best of the best during the housing boom, during the 90s expansion, we would maybe get to 6.5-7% vacancy at the low point. And we got to under 3%. And so that just threw rents through the roof. They grew 22% year on year in 2021, 2022. That was the fastest growth year. We saw supply start to respond. What's happening now is a bit of a normalization in the market. So people will see vacancies are going up. We're now kind of in the mid 5 range from 2.8. But again, that's historically better than anything we've ever seen before. And demand is slowing. And we actually made an unpopular forecast that not only last year would demand slow, but this year, because of that pull forward effect, right? And that sort of right sizing with respect to the e-commerce trajectory, which we think will work its way through by the middle of next year. And then we'll start to see an acceleration in what we call net absorption again. So this recalibration in industrial from the fundamental side is really, okay, well, we're going to get probably a peak vacancy rate middle of next year around 6.8, maybe 7%. That's like on par with the lowest we had ever seen before in prior cycles. And so this like window of opportunity that tenants have to actually get some space and have some pressure off the rent growth is finite. And that's been really probably the biggest challenge is companies that occupy this space absorbing the cost increases. And they've been most acute in places you'd expect, Southern California, New Jersey, where markets and land are, you know, markets are very, very tight. But from an investor perspective, right, remember that the weighted average lease term is still about 6.7, 6.8 years. So even as rent growth slows down, we see some upward movement in vacancy, although it's still very low, we still have many leases that with their escalations are underpriced to market. And so when an investor has that in their portfolio and that lease rolls, they're able to market to market. And that income growth is going to fuel NOI returns, which in this environment with interest rates is a very important dynamic. And that is why it remains so favored. You still see pricing going up. You don't see cap rate expansion because, you know, you know that if you come in and buy a building, you're still going to be able to push the NOI and your effective cap rate would even be different in 1 year from now. So that asset class just remains absolutely favored. There's structural demand for it. It's going through normalization right now, which we think is healthy and good for the market. Data centers, we track separately. And this is, again, an area where it's structural demand. We're tracking right now the pipeline of future data centers and the amount of, we track them not by square footage, but by energy, right? And so the amount that's underway will increase what we have by 2.5 times what we currently have at the moment. So it's a 250% growth rate over the next few years. The number one constraint that really dictates how that can come online is power availability. And that's really where, you know, the rubber hits the road in terms of, okay, how do we get this? The number of requests coming into utilities is insane. And they haven't had to expand their bandwidth, you know, for 2 decades. So this is very new to them. They're not used to building 250% you know, ability to generate power in just 5 years. So that's going to be probably the constraint. It's making that market where there is a rental market for that space. Vacancies are at, you know, 1%, 0%. Rents are going up 10, 20%, depending on the market. We're seeing some shifts into secondary markets. It depends on, you know, every mega player has their own strategy in this way. We're seeing huge swaths of land being taken down for the purpose of building huge data centers and or also co-locating next to microgrids so they don't need to rely on utilities building out power. So we're literally seeing anywhere from 200 to 500 acres, 1,000 acres being purchased. We've had some that are much more significant than that. I would say where we're watching power come online, the greatest is happening in the Southwest. And then up into the Pacific Northwest, Texas has a tremendous amount, particularly in that Dallas-Houston corridor, right around Long Island in the Northeast. You see wind energy, significant amount of wind underway. And that's important just because a lot of companies that are building data centers or providing data center services to other tech companies or other companies, there are sustainability goals that need to be met. So we're very focused on what is the kind of power also that's fueling the ability of these data centers to come online, but absolutely a growth area and you see capital following it on an institutional basis.
Well, I like rubber hits the road, bananas. Those are things I wouldn't say, but so those are Rebecca Rocky aphorisms, but yeah. Those are good ones. Let's play the game real quick. The game is the stats game. We each pick a statistic. The rest of the group tries to figure it out with the cues, deductive reasoning, and clues. And the best stat is one that's not so easy that we get it immediately. One that's not so hard we never get it. And if it's apropos to the topic at hand, all the better. And we always begin with Marissa. Marissa, you're up.
Okay. First, let me say this is not a. I'm not going to say anything. Never mind. Sorry.
What?
27.4.
What the heck was that? That's not fair.
I was gonna help you out before I gave you the stat, but I'm not gonna help you. Okay, 27.4%.
It's not CRE related.
It is indirectly.
She always
CRE.
Does this. You see how it she is, does this? It is, but it
it's
isn't.
It's not a vacancy rate. That's what I mean. Okay. It's not directly CRE related, but it is very relevant.
Percent
to the remote conversation we just had about CRE.
Percent remote work?
Yes.
Is that the one from BLS?
After all that.
Yeah. I guess you didn't need help. Yeah, that's from the latest Census Bureau's Pulse survey. The results of the March to April came out yesterday. And that is the number of people that are doing any remote work, either whether it's one day a week or it's 5 days a week. So it's 27.4%. Guess what it was a year ago?
30%.
27%.
Oh, is that right?
Like even. So it's to your point, right? We talked about this with the office. It's kind of seems like it's at this level and it's not changing, right?
Yeah, because Pulse has only been around since the survey's only been around since the pandemic.
And those are the only two data points for this. So they didn't ask about specifically about remote work in this way prior to 2023.
Well, the broader statistics, that feels consistent with the broader. I think there's other similar.
Yeah, there are other measures, right? And it's kind of in that like.
I think it got up to like 35-40% and it's came back in and it's kind of stabilized around 25.
Yeah, you mentioned the badge swipe data.
The badge swipe data. Yeah.
And it's somewhere. It's kind of in that ballpark. But the point is to the conversation that it seems to have settled into this sort of average. Yeah.
Way to go, Chris. That was good.
I guess it wasn't hard.
Chris, did you see that? That was a dig.
It wasn't meant to be.
I'm used to it.
Rebecca, would you like to go next?
Sure. I'm not sure how easy this will be for such experts as yourselves.
You mortals down there, non-CRE mortals. This is like way above you guys. See, those are fighting words, man.
I think I think you might get it. That's what I mean. 44.3%.
44.3% CRE related?
Yes.
She's just like Marissa. The way she does this this head fake thing. She's saying yes, but she's shaking her head no.
Is it office market related?
It's not office market related.
Okay. It's tangentially related to CRE.
Yes, and some would include it in their definition of CRE. Others would say non-farm, non-residential, and residential.
That's a big hint somehow. Sounds like a big hint.
Yeah.
Is it related to the multifamily market?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I thought so. What's 44.3% in the multifamily market? Is that the share of multifamily debt that is the banking system has? The banking system has 44.3% of the multifamily mortgage debt outstanding.
That's not what it is. That seems high because of the agencies to me, but
that's probably true.
Yes, but it's not debt related.
It's not debt related. It's not debt related. It's not finance related credit.
It came out this week.
Oh, and the housing starts data, the multifamily housing starts. So permit, what would be, what, Chris, you would know that data really well. What would be, that right, Rebecca? It was in the housing starts data that came out? Yeah, okay. Because multifamily was low. It came in at like 300K or something like that. That was the total number of starts. And, oh, is it, in single family was about 1 million. It wasn't 44% of all starts were multifamily or 44% of, no.
Hmm.
Damn, what could it be? We know
it's a share. It's not a percent change.
No, it's a percent change. It's
not. Oh, it is a percent change. Permits of multifamily.
Yeah. It didn't have a negative sign. It has a positive sign.
It is a decline of.
That's a decline in the number negative of starts. 44. Percentage, yes, decline in the number of starts.
Change,
yeah.
The March multifamily starts, which, the census data has been a little funky. You know, we track the square footage and that goes into the pipeline and starts. It's off by 52-53% on a quarterly basis. We don't track it monthly. Their data's bouncing all around. So it's finally kind of lining up a bit more. But that's, you know, I chose it because we really see the construction pipelines thinning out, and it's true for all sectors, but for multifamily, obviously the supply wave has been the big phenomena driving the market. And then there's this air pocket behind the supply wave. And, you know, so the softness in that market will not persist indefinitely.
That's so over what time period?
A
year ago. Okay.
Month was 20% down or something, right?
Yeah. It was a big decline. Yeah. So Rebecca, so I just understand, you're saying the census data on the number of multifamily units that have been started have been relatively elevated, but the data you track has been showing much weaker construction activity. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been consistently coming down.
Yeah.
And even at the end of last year, it was off by 50% year on year.
Yeah.
So we were waiting, you know, sometimes when the census report comes out, the can be just a little volatile. So you sometimes get head scratching months. And this was one where things made a bit more sense to us.
So 300,000 units, that's annualized, is more consistent with your data, not the 400,000 to 500,000 per month we've been getting previously. Okay. Interesting. Which I guess it was just a matter of time, given we have rising vacancy, we've got weakening rents, we've got lenders that are tightening down underwriting, we've got price declines. It just feels like it was going to show up at here at some point in terms of less construction, and that's what we're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's do one more. Chris, and then we'll move on. Chris, we want to do yours?
Okay, I'll give you the easy one because we're running out of time.
Oh, okay.
All right. 940,000.
That's not the number of units under construction, is it?
Yes, it is.
Oh, jeez.
Told you, it was easy.
He always goes to this, you know, every single time he goes to the same well.
Well,
he's the housing guy.
Well, that was good. You had a good stat, Mark. Maybe you can.
Yeah, give us
a stat.
Give us yours.
Yeah, what's yours? Because you said we would never get it, right?
Yeah, you'll never get it. You'll never get it.
Try us.
Actually, I got a lot of great stats. I'll give you the easier stat, 17%.
CRE.
And that is related. I'll give you a hint. It's CRE related. It's retail related.
Is it from the release this week?
It is. Yes, it is. It's from a release this week from, yes, it is. I won't say which release.
The percent change in e-commerce sales?
No, but you're in the ballpark. It's the share of total retail sales that are non-store, that are, you know, basically online. And that's up 5 percentage points from pre-pandemic. The peak was 19%. Guess which month we hit 19%?
April 2020.
There you go, April 2020. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I've got another great statistic, but I'm going to wait for next week to give it to you because it's a really good one. on multifamily rents, a really good one. But we got to move on. We're getting long in the tooth. I want to come back, you know, after I, this is a bunch, you know, Rebecca, a lot of happy talk in this conversation. And actually, Marissa led you down the primrose path here. Tell me about data centers, you know? Yeah. Oh, like, and you're going, oh, it's bananas. It's bananas. 1% vacancy. No problem. No problem. Okay.
The whole That's a great impression.
Yeah, that sounded just like me.
That was perfect.
Right. I would have taken you down the dark path, the multifamily path, but the darker path, because, you know, everyone was hair on fire, you know, 6 months ago, doom loop. We're going to see rates are up, vacancy is up, prices are down. We're going to see more defaults on mortgages, CRE mortgages. That results in more property being thrown onto the market at distressed price. Prices come in and you get into this kind of self-reinforcing cycle down. And adding to the concern is the banking system is exposed, the financial system broadly exposed because they make, you know, loans into these, into the properties. And we're going to see some bank failure, and that's just going to add to the, you know, overall problems out there. And then on top of that, you know, a lot of the most of the if not all the problems are in large downtown urban areas. And, you know, those areas are going to be much diminished by, you know, what's going on here. San Francisco is the poster child for that. But that feels like that's kind of the hair on fire is been put out. People are much more relaxed about that. And should they be? I mean, and maybe I should ask it this way, because I'm sure you're going to say, yeah, they should be more relaxed about it. What is the scenario where things don't play out, you know, well, you know, what could cause that? I mean, I don't know if that's a fair question, but I'll just pose it just to see what you, if you have a perspective on that.
Yeah, I think, you know, the unsexy part of the credit cycle going on in CRE is just that it takes time, you know? And so we're in the early stages. We think we're in probably, you know, just 18 months into a 7-year cycle. So kind of think about that, and it's just going to take time to materialize. And usually it's in years 2, 3, 4, where you start to see the preponderance of distress start to pick up. And so, you know, it isn't to diminish and say everything is fine in the world. Absolutely, these large urban centers, especially in gateway markets with elevated vacancy, they have distress coming. You're seeing that in sort of one-off headlines around the owners walking away, the kinds of price declines that are out there. And there is absolutely more to come. And you can see it in real-time delinquency rates on CMBS, where, you know, you basically have sub 1% delinquency in most property types.
Commercial mortgage-backed securities, CMBS, so securitized mortgage loans, yeah.
Right. Multifamily actually jumped up this month to about 1.5-ish% from about 0.5%. And that was due to one property, a student housing property in San Francisco. So, you know, that's not a nationwide issue. That's that one property. Office has gone up from around a low of 1.5 during the aftermath of the pandemic and forbearance and all the things to 7.5. And it's still climbing. So I think that's indicative of just how it stands alone in this particular cycle. You know, from my point of view, it's manageable, right? So any given owner, whether it's a bank or otherwise, generally has limited exposure to office. And I think this particularly becomes of interest in the banking sector because, of course, banks have lots of tentacles into the economy when they're struggling with putting reserves aside and managing their portfolios and their tightening standards on lending just really sort of crimps activity and growth. And that's what we're seeing in the commercial real estate markets now more broadly. But they're finding ways to work through. We've seen actually in this quarter with some of the bank earnings calls, you know, some some positive news actually with respect to how CRE is holding up. Some write-offs, right, that maybe led to some charge-offs, but manageable in the context of their broader portfolio. Keep in mind, office, CBD office is something like 5% of the big bank's CRE portfolio. So yes, it's there, but it's part of this mm-hmm. $2.9 trillion exposure that they have. That exposure is diverse across markets, property types, and CBD office is really just one of those, let alone CBD office in the harder hit urban markets. You also have, of course, extensions going on, modifications. We're seeing actually cash-in refis, which is something that's unusual. We usually see cash-out refinances in commercial real estate. You're seeing banks get a little bit of an upper hand, actually, and require deposits or some other form of recourse that they wouldn't typically be able to demand as they work with borrowers. Of course, with office, you know, they have an incentive to do that in the sense they also don't want the property. But at the same time, you can't inevitably, forestall what is going to happen, which is more defaults, more credit pressure on the office sector in particular, and that being more acute in these gateway and larger urban centers. So I think that's just going to play out. Chris and I have spoken a bit about the doom loop in the past, and does that move the macroeconomic needle? Does that cause some kind of recession? Probably not. It's just a slow burn. And that ultimately then starts to materialize in things like state and local governments and cities and their budgets and so on. And that just also takes time. And it's not inevitable, especially if you're able to do successfully what some cities have done in the past, which is reinvent that downtown area, which I think we're in the very early stages of. And in that way, I think about it as, there are going to be losses, but there are going to be tremendous gains as you put that real estate to its highest and best use in this post-pandemic world. And so there is a sort of value gain, right? Perhaps even on net, we can add value to the commercial real estate stock if we're removing low quality office and adding something higher value there. And how that plays out from a doom loop perspective, I think is just, it's not inevitable. And it's difficult to distinguish between a cycle in commercial real estate, whether that's in the fundamentals or even the credit market, versus actually a doom loop taking place. I do think some cities face a real risk of that if they do not make a concerted effort to think about policy, public-private partnerships, getting the downtown to adapt from a place where maybe there was an overdependence on office workers and office worker production, and to make themselves more of a consumption destination. And that's something that we're in the early stages of. I mean, there are signs all around the country that that's happening. To your question about a darker scenario, I think anything that triggers bank stress beyond, in an economy that's expanding, a tenure that's at 4-ish, and we just have this slow burn of a credit cycle for all lender types, including banks, I think something that really puts acute stress on the banks, a rapid run up in interest rates that's sustained beyond what markets are pricing in at this point, that I think could create outcomes that are much darker than the ones I just described. So I don't think anybody's base case, but there are black swan events all the time. And so we remain aware that that's always a possibility at the tail end. But that would be sort of how to frame that up.
Yeah. I joke. I agree with you. I think the most likely scenario is that you said slow burn. I think that's the kind of a way to think about it.
Yeah.
Like a bit of a corrosive, but there's no cliff event here. At least doesn't feel that way. Unless something, you're going to need something else to go off the rails cause the economy to pull back and interest rates to spike, that kind of thing. Chris, Marissa, do you want to push back on what Rebecca said? Anything there that you would push back on?
No, but what is a cash in refi?
So typically when companies or investors have refinanced in the past, it's been in this environment where interest rates were structurally declining, so you can refinance and actually take cash out, right, of the property. Now, in order to meet the lending criteria of LTV, debt coverage service ratio, and so on, we're seeing refinances where borrowers actually have to bring equity into the deal. But, you know, they believe in it. And believe it or not, there are actually a lot of office refinancings going on, and just at the right price with the right kind of loan condition.
They're putting equity in. They're not, they need more equity. The bank's saying, hey, you got to put more equity into the deal. But which is a good sign that they're willing to put the equity in.
Right.
They think the value's there. Okay. Chris, anything you want to push back on?
Not really push back. Just I think emphasize maybe some of that extend and pretend that's going on there, that the banks are accommodating and extending loans, but we're also kind of gambling on better days, right? That things will improve in the future. Interest rates will come down so that we can, you know, we consolidate and go forward here. So I don't think that the macro doom loop is a real risk, but I do think that there is some risk there. Certainly if that scenario doesn't play out, you combine this with some more negative outcome at the end of the term, right? Then we certainly could see more stress.
Well, Rebecca, it was a great conversation. Sorry we kept you longer than I anticipated, but I appreciate you taking the time with us. But thank you. Thank you for doing that.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Anytime. And we got to have you back on Fair Value, although only three people in the world are going to listen to that podcast if we do it. But
it's pretty out there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty out, but really important, actually shockingly important. But anyway, well, with that, dear listener, we are going to call this a podcast. Take care, everyone.